Last lecture, we're going to talk about TRG that we've learned about. We're going to see how it relates to the renormalization group flow. We'll do it by first briefly reminding you of the renormalization group, and then see what type of flow we generate with TRG, and then we'll talk about a way of generating a proper RG flow with tensor networks. And this is the last lecture. What I'm going to say might not be that relevant to the tutorial this afternoon. It's more of a let's see a broader picture, things that have happened that may be harder to implement. So we're not going to try to implement it this afternoon. But still, I want you to know related more recent developments. So the renormalization group, we have that we have a Hamiltonian. That's the guy we are interested in. We would like to understand the properties of attached to this Hamiltonian, maybe a thermal state, maybe if this was a quantum system, the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And in general, we can characterize this Hamiltonian in terms of coupling constants. And the idea of the renormalization group is to study how this coupling constant changes as we somehow, and this somehow is important, somehow change the length scale or the energy scale at which we are observing the system. Okay, so we need to specify what we mean by going from H1 to H1, from H to H prime, and so on. We need to specify what it means to change scale. But the idea is that the renormalization group comes with some notion of how to change scale, and then we are going to study how the couplings of this Hamiltonian evolve as we change scale. So we could plot the space of couplings. This is a two-dimensional projection. Of course, this space of couplings is infinite dimensional. And what we could do is we could study how our Hamiltonian changes as we change the scale. And that defines some flow. And that's nice because we can focus on in this flow, in the space of couplings, we can then identify different phases. Okay, our Hamiltonian starting here may float in this direction. And also, if it was starting here, it may flow in this direction. Whereas if it started nearby, it may flow in another direction. And that's how we can find phases and also identify stable fixed points representing those phases of matter. And finally, also in between, we can have some critical fixed points, which such that they are a fixed point if you stay quiet right there. But if you change your couplings a little bit, you quickly flow away to another fixed point. OK? So that's the RG flow, usual stuff. Now, what we want to do is something not as usual, because we want to throw away the picture of Hamiltonians. We want to see whether we can repeat this type of construction in the space of tensors. Since we've been able to rewrite our partition function as a tensor network now, and we can coarse grain our tensors, the question is whether this defines a good RG flow. Now, so the question is, can we define an RG flow in the space of tensors? And the short, just quickly, so that we don't get confused, the answer eventually will be yes, we can do that. But it's not going to be with TRG. Okay, we'll have to change that a little bit. So how is this going to happen? Remember, we have a coarse-grain transformation with TRG. Okay, and that simplifies the lattice in the sense that the number of sides is changing. But you could imagine that you start with an infinite lattice, and therefore the number of sides remains infinite at every step. Okay? So the number of sides is not what you want to focus on. You want to focus on the tensor, how this tensor, the coarse-grain tensor, is changing with coarse-grain step. That's what we would like to investigate. Good. So we have this a prime, a second, as a result of coarse-graining. And does TRG define an RG flow in the space of tensors? And we already saw an example before by studying the spectrum of singular values as a function of the iteration step. Let me plot something closely related. I just want to directly take a picture of the tensor. Okay? How do you take a picture of a tensor? Well, this would be a tensor with four indices. I join two indices together, and I get a matrix. And then what I plot here is a 16 times 16 matrix. Okay? The bond dimension was 4, so I put two indices and two indices together. That's 16 times 16. So now you have a matrix, and you just plot all the elements according to their absolute value. Right? So black means very close to 0. White means very close to 1 or something like that. Okay? So what you see here, this plot is telling you that this matrix, which is coming from the tensor, this matrix has a number of elements that are very close to 0 and a number of elements that are not close to 0. This is the absolute value of the different elements. Okay? And now you can ask, what happens to this tensor as we change scale, as we coarse grain? Okay? Is it clear what this picture means? Okay? You could plot this this afternoon. We won't do it, but you could do it. Just take your tensor, turn it into a matrix, and look at how large the individual components are. And so we don't want to get too obsessed with a particular picture. What we want to see is the sequence of pictures. What we have is that we start with some tensor. This is very close to the relatively close to the critical temperature or critical beta, okay, 0.9 critical beta. And what we do is we coarse grain, and we coarse grain, and we coarse grain. And what do we see already? Well, what we see is that this is going to a fixed point, okay. This tensor and this tensor look very much the same. We started with a different one, but as we coarse grain, this is flowing to some stable fixed point tensor. So the question is not whether, so we see we can get the fixed point, but the question is whether the flow that we're generating has the right structure of fixed points. Okay? So what would be the right structure of fixed points for the Ising model? Well, you all know the answer. If we start at critical temperature, we should stay there. Okay? So beta critical, which has this approximate value, if we start with this beta and we coarse grain, we would expect to stay there to get already a fixed point of the coarse graining. Okay? If this is the right RG, if this coarse grain defines an RG flow, we expect a critical point, a fixed point at the critical temperature. We then expect another critical point at beta equal to infinite or zero temperature. Okay? That would be the low temperature or symmetry breaking fixed point. And we would expect large temperatures or small beta, also another fixed point. Okay? So the summary, this is the Ising model. You've seen it 1,000 times. Summary is that we expect two stable fixed points, one symmetry breaking fixed point, one disordered fixed point. Okay? Symmetry breaking and disordered fixed point. And then one unstable critical fixed point at critical beta. Okay? That's what we would like to get. So if TRG defines a good RG flow, TRG should take your tensors and make them converge to one of these three options, depending on where what beta is. Okay? So that's what we would like to see. Now, what happens in practice? Well, we see something else. So let me show you an example. I'm going to start with beta below critical beta, so 0.9 and 0.5 times the critical beta. So these two tensors, now I repeat the same story as before, right? I start with this tensor, and then I coarse grain it, and I reach some fixed point. Now I start with this tensor. This is supposed to be in the same phase. And we look at the coarse grain transformation, and it indeed goes to a fixed point again. But the problem is these two fixed points don't look the same. Okay? So in a proper RG flow, you would expect that anything that is below or above the critical temperature would go to one or the other fixed point. Okay? Here we have two betas which are on the same side. Okay? This should all flow to the beta equal to zero fixed point. But what we find is two different fixed points. Okay? So that's wrong. Good. So actually, you could repeat this for different values of beta, always below beta critical. And for each such values of beta, we'll flow to a different fixed point. Okay? So something is happening here where the fixed point remembers the initial temperature. Okay? We have an RG flow, a strange flow, where the final tensor remembers the microscopic details where you started from. You can read from the final tensor, you can read which temperature you started from. In a proper RG flow, all these microscopic details would be forgotten, and you would just remember whether you were to the right or to the left of the critical temperature.
A stupid question to this one. So if you take the A triple prime in the lower row and you rescale up the columns, can you get back to the first row? So it seems like you replaced the white pattern by a yellow pattern.
No, look again. No way.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Okay, how many of you cannot see the red color?
I know. The red values could be absorbed into the black.
Sure. If you change the matrices, they will look the same. Yes. Okay, so it was a serious question. So the serious answer is that yes, there is some similarity here. Okay, but clearly these are not the same tensors even after rescaling. So let me tell you that they have been, that rescaling will not fix this. Yeah. Okay, and if I plotted more tensors, that would become more clear. Yes, very good. Any other question? Good. So this is not a proper RGflow. Okay. So two questions. What did go wrong? Let's try to understand what happened. Why is this not giving us an RGflow? And second, can we fix that? Question.
Sorry, what happens for beta larger than beta
smaller?
Same. Same thing?
Yeah.
OK, so this is not just for beta smaller than beta smaller.
That's right. Yes. And you can try this afternoon. You have all you need, OK, this afternoon. Even you can rescale the tensors and everything. OK, so what went wrong? TRG cannot remove some short-range correlations. Okay? What's happening is that TRG is unable to forget enough about where we started. So the original partition function corresponds to a given temperature. This is encoded in the detailed structure of correlations in that partition function. And TRG is coarse-graining, but is unable to forget completely about some of these microscopic details, which really should be removed. Okay? So TRG remembers too much. It's keeping too much. When we were compressing, okay, we were keeping things that include irrelevant information, irrelevant from an RGFIC perspective. Okay? So actually, we can go back to our toy model with this, how do I call this? CDL, corner double line tensors. Okay? We can go back to that construction, and we'll see exactly what's happening. So what we can do is we can consider, again, tensors that, as we did yesterday, are just these corner double line tensors. Okay? They factorize in this given way. And then we have the if we put four of these blue tensors here, and don't worry about the color green and red. You'll see why I'm doing that. But these lines correspond to these four lines here. So four lines, four lines, four lines, right? You see four blue tensors right there? If we apply an SVD in this way, as we would do in TRG, then we will break this blue ball into two tensors, okay? And then we'll do some SVD and so on. We'll simplify things. Well, this is what happens after applying TRG one step. This is just a number. Remember, this green circle is just a trace. It's a number. So we can remove it, okay? And here, something very interesting happened. This was our initial tensor. This is our new final tensor. It's tilted, right, as we expect. We go from square lattice in horizontal or vertical direction to square lattice like this. So we have a tensor that looks exactly the same as the original tensor. So CDL tensors are a fixed point of TRG. This procedure, you input a partition function, which is a CDL type of partition function, only short-range correlations, and spits out a CDL, a partition function of the same type. Okay? Remember, CDL partition functions that can be written in terms of these tensors, only contain short distance details. An RG transformation, a proper RG transformation, the first thing you should do is throw away those details, okay? Because they don't belong to the IR physics. They are really short distance details. But we just saw we applied TRG to this partition function, and we got back a partition function that locally looks exactly the same than the one we started from. So this is already a fixed point of the TRG transformation. Okay? Even though these short-range correlations should disappear. So this is the color coding that I had, and the two steps of that, right? We start with a lattice like this, we tilt it, and then we put it back. So after two coarse-graining steps, we go from this picture to this picture. And now the reason why I'm coloring the correlations, the loops, in two different colors, the first green ones are the ones that disappear. They don't appear here anymore. Okay, through the SVDs and truncations, they have disappeared. But we have also the red guys. And the red guys are originally short-distance correlations, just going around the four sides, which have been not just safe from the coarse-graining, but actually promoted to longer distance correlations. Okay? So there is something going wrong here. we, instead of throwing away all short distance correlations, some of the short distance correlations, TRG promotes them to longer distance correlations. Okay? And this is this in these short distance correlations, that's where we keep the information about the original temperature. That's why the fixed point depends on the initial temperature and not whether we are above or below the critical temperature. Okay? So we understand what went wrong with TRG. And when I say what went wrong, I'm not saying the method is not extremely useful. Okay? Yeah. That's why you're learning it, because it's very useful. But if you want to interpret the method as an RG transformation, then there is a problem. Okay? It's an interpretation problem. Okay, good. It's good to understand what the problem is, because then you have a go at solving it. So what did go wrong? Using just SVDs, singular value decompositions, turns out using just SVDs is not enough to remove all short distance correlations. Most of them, all the green guys, are gone from this picture. But the red ones survived and had been upgraded to longer distance correlations. Okay? So that's what went wrong. Now, can we fix it? Okay? And the answer is yes. So now I want to briefly tell you how this has been fixed. This goes under the name of tensor network renormalization. It's work done with Glenn Evenly not long ago. And there is some blah, blah, blah attached to it, and I'm just going to read it. We introduced these entanglers, whatever that is, to remove all short-range correlations. And as a result, we obtain a proper RG flow. Okay, with the right structure of fixed points. We'll see this in a minute. And it works also near criticality or at the critical point. So, and these are the technical details. And I just draw this so that you don't bother, you know, you don't even ask me about how it works. Okay? This is how it works. Okay? There are letters A, B, C, D, E, F. Okay. And then some technical details. But the thing is, when you compose this on the lattice, right, it doesn't look better. Mm-hmm. But if you just don't look, or you go with your eyes very, very fast from here to here, and you just remember that you started on this lattice, square lattice, and you end up with a square lattice, you say, aha, A and A prime. That's all you need to remember. Okay? If you're interested in the method, you know, I don't even know if I want to talk about it, but probably we could talk about it, okay? But I don't want to discuss it now. I just want to tell you that you can modify TRG in this way, and by adding some extra tensors called these entanglers, and the net result is something that from outside looks like, okay, we go from A to A prime. Now, let's have a look, though, what happens in practice. So this was TRG, okay? We've known it for over 10 years now. And as I said, it's a very useful method to coarse grain. When we apply it to two different temperatures, which are on the same side of the phase diagram, we just saw that the tensors, AA prime and the coarse graining, flow to different fixed points, and that should not be the case. When we use this newer method, TNR, tensor network renormalization, we start with the same tensors, okay, so the same betas, and now we flow to a fixed point, we flow to the same fixed point, okay? So we've managed, thanks to introducing this complex thing, you can clean up short distance correlations, and you end up not only with the same tensor, but with a tensor which looks terribly simple, okay? This matrix is all zeros but a one right there, okay? This is the disordered phase, okay? And this is the just saying that when you remove all the short distance correlations, you're left with nothing, okay? Just a product state, so to say. The interpretation is much more cleaner when talking about quantum states. This is a partition function, but all I'm saying is that each single spin is in a mixture of up or down. That's what it's saying. Every single spin is in an infinite temperature state. Okay, so just one point. Very good. So. So what's the claim? TNR converges to one of three RG fixed points consistent with the proper RG flow. So let's have a look. Before we were asking, what about the symmetry breaking phase? So let's do that. We start with a temperature or a beta which is very close to the critical one. But under coarse graining, this simplifies. Okay. If we started at the critical point, this first changes a little bit, but then stabilizes. It becomes constant. So we have a critical fixed point. And finally, at high temperature or beta below critical beta, we go to the to another fixed point that we just discussed before. Okay. So what we see is, and now I could change beta. As long as I am on the right side of the critical beta, I get always the same fixed point. And if I'm on the other side, I get this other fixed point. Okay. And if I'm right at criticality, I get something that is another fixed point, which is more complicated. And it's not by chance that if you look at this tensor, this tensor, in some sense, is a direct sum of two copies of this one. Okay, that's because right there you have a symmetry breaking phase. So there is a zero. This is the zero temperature phase. So you could have all the spins up. That's one point, or all the spins down. That's the other point. Okay, and there was this question before whether we could now split the two contributions and find a non-zero magnetization. This guy will give you a non-zero magnetization, this one, and this one will give you non-zero magnetization minus one. So if you keep the two components of this partition function, you still get the average is zero. Okay, very good. So this is what you can do. And so are there questions about this? Okay. So now I want to go back to what's that? Whatever. TRG at criticality. Remember, we go back to criticality TRG, and remember that we had this singular spectrum of singular values as we were considering the tensors, right? We split the tensor, we look at the singular values. And I mentioned before that at criticality, the number of singular values that we need to keep kept growing, right? Okay, and that was a computational problem. It's not just conceptual, it's actual calculations have to face this problem. So now let's plot in the same place the spectrum of TNR. Okay, so this was the original spectrum for both TRG and TNR, and as we constrain, TNR keeps something that looks basically the same spectrum at each iteration. Okay, this happens automatically, that the spectrum of singular values does not grow with iteration. Okay, it's constant at criticality. Okay. So what that means is that, well, first, the singular values continue to decay very fast and converge to a spectrum that is constant. This is a new fixed point. And each iteration, therefore, has the same cost. Okay, so that means we can iterate forever. We can take a critical chain and iterate forever. And now forever came with a star. And you really should ask forever, what does forever mean? So let me tell you with an example what forever means. So we start at the critical temperature with one dimension very small, just four for simplicity. And you start with this tensor, and it evolves a little bit. It's practically the same. And then at the critical point, right, you constrain once, twice, three times, four times, and five, six, seven, eight. And you get back the same tensor. Okay, and guess why I didn't put the next one here? You see that this yellow becomes orange. Okay, so it's not forever. Okay, after a finite number of iterations, you lose the fixed point. But this happens after many iterations. So remember, every time we do that, one step of this corresponds to multiplying by four the number of spins. So what the block, you have a block of spins. Your tensor represents four spins. I don't know this, 16, blah, 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 right? So this is what, 4 to the 12, which is like millions, okay? Millions of spins. So, and then the method fails, okay? Yes?
Does it make sense to go backwards? To iterate in the other direction? Of course, to find. Then the point should be a factor.
Sorry,
if
what's that?
It makes sense.
Well, I guess that's something you may want to do, but when you go in the other direction, you have to inform the system of what it is that you had removed earlier, right? So in one direction, you throw away, easy. In the other direction, you would have to put back. What are you going to put back? Right?
Nothing. OK.
OK, yeah, yes, yes. I mean, yeah, we could think about it. OK, so is this just because, you know, we are plotting the same thing many times and I'm tricking you? So what we can do is we can change beta a little bit, just a little bit, OK? So this is beta almost 1. Okay, so now we are slightly off criticality. So what do we expect? Well, we expect to stay to essentially see no difference for a while. Okay, but at some point, once you've constrained long enough, you know, being slightly away from criticality means having a finite correlation length which is very, very large. So the moment that you reach that correlation length, the moment your tensors effectively contain as many spins as that correlation length, you suddenly flow to the all well-known fixed point, okay? To the right fixed point. Very good. So great. So I'm going to be done earlier, but I guess that's good. No, everybody is happy with that. So, so let me. Are there questions about that before? Are there questions? Yes, question.
Sorry, these fixed points, they kind of go in the full space as tensors. So if you consider the space of, say, all matrices, all colors
yes.
of these 256 yes. squares,
yes.
would they all flow to these three?
No, no. No, actually, if we had Z3 symmetry, we would be flowing to another fixed point, say the Potts model, three-state Potts model, right? When you start with a partition function and you write it as a tensor, this tensor is not an arbitrary tensor. It's coming from the partition function. It will have the symmetries of the partition function. In this case, in the IJ model, the Z2 symmetry is there. Right? If we had started with a partition function of the three-state Potts model, there's instead of Z2, we have Z3 symmetry, then we would see different fixed points. Yes. So the space of tensors is very generic. It doesn't inform you of which partition function it started from, which is nice. It means that you will have very large richness of fixed points.
But I guess within a space of 256 numbers, there's only a finite number of models.
Sure. Oh, is that the question?
Yeah.
I thought you were stretching. Sorry.
So the tensors, different tensors can give you the same representation of the partition function.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, so you could actually kind of rotate the tensors, but have actually a fixed point. So why does that not happen here? Or how do you make sure that
right,
this,
you.
If you plot, I mean,
right. So it's true that in all this tensor network business, you can make you can go to any index connecting two tensors and make a change of basis. Change of basis there. And this will change this matrix. Okay. So maybe this white dot could have shown up down here. Okay. But if for TNR it just happens naturally because you are trying to squeeze things. Okay, that the squeezable, well, the things that cannot be squeezed end up here. Okay, but if you didn't have that, you can always, so you have a method that produces a matrix, which is a fixed point, then you run something else and you get another matrix and you want to know whether they are the same fixed point. Well, you could ask matrices or tensors, you could ask, can I relate these two tensors, right? So this is the first tensor, A, and then you have A prime. And you could look at invariants, but another thing you could ask is, well, if I change basis here by some unitary transformation, right, U and U daga, these are unitary transformations, V and V daga, you could ask, can I compute the difference between these two tensors as a function of U and U, as a function of changing the basis? And can I find a change of basis where this distance is very small, meaning that in that basis, the two tensors look the same? Right. You could ask these questions. And these are not hard computational. These are very simple questions. You can write this algorithm. It's easy to write, and it works very well. So
it's more convenient than comparing invariants?
Sorry?
It's more convenient than comparing invariants?
You could compare invariants, but invariants may be the same, and yet that doesn't mean that the tensors are the same. You would need a complete set of invariants.
Yeah.
Yes. So if you have a complete set of invariants, yes. You could either do this or compare a complete set of invariants. But most likely, you will not have a complete set of invariants. Right? If these were matrices, yes, you would have a complete set. It's the eigenvalues of the matrices. When you have tensors, there are many things that you need to consider before you have a complete set. Yes. OK, good. So any other question? So yes?
So you sort of presented this way of actually getting to a true RG flow as a black box, but the sort of the error propagation still remains analytical, right? So you still understand that you're
right. So we had that after 12 iterations, things went wrong. 13 and 14 were a disaster. That's the effect of propagating this error.
So it's clear that at some point it breaks down?
It always breaks down, sooner or later.
But can you predict analytically at which point that happens? Because it seemed, in the simple models we were discussing, that you had a very clear understanding of what your error is while going through the RG flow.
So when I'm confronted with a tensor like this, I'm not in the mood to try to find an analytical interpretation of what's happening, right? I mean, you could, possibly. It might be very useful to find such a thing. But in the end, you know, I just cosign a few steps, and eventually it breaks. And
but it's an unstable fixed point.
Yes.
Yeah, it's clear that it breaks at some point.
Yeah, it has to break at some point. And it's basically, if you do 12 iterations, it means you didn't match the 12th number.
So
some high digit.
No, but the temperature at which start comes with 16 digits of accuracy or something like that. If you do that. Okay, so every time you truncate something, every time you manipulate matrices, there is a machine precision there, right, that kicks in. And if this machine precision corresponds to a relevant perturbation of the fixed point, this will grow over time. But I don't even think this is the big problem. The big problem is that we were still, even in this case, we were truncating at, say, 10 to the minus 4. Right? So there is a 10 to the minus 5 guy there that over iterations, boom, becomes order 1.
Yeah. So the fact that this is linear, that these errors are linear, still remains with the advanced method?
These errors are linear, but the system size that you're considering grows exponentially with the iteration. Right, so it hits you sooner or later. But it's OK. In the end, it's not about achieving perfection. It's about having a match between the concepts that you expect, an RG flow, and the numerics. Right? This, I would call it a fixed point, numerical fixed point, which will eventually go away because of numerical problems, accumulation of numerical errors. It turns out that if you preserve Z2 symmetry explicitly, which we did with these tensors, but I don't. Yeah, there are ways of eliminating possible relevant perturbations from the fixed point, and then you are left with some others only. And those are, unless something really goes wrong, you expect that to stick to the Ising model. If you preserve Z2 symmetry, then there would be these two phases basically. This is not necessarily the case. You could end up, for instance, if we had not preserved Z2 symmetry, we could have another perturbation that takes you away from the critical Ising model in another direction, which is not the beta direction, okay, and reach another fixed point.
So no.
In general, we cannot prevent this from being perfect. What is nice is to see that, you know, stop looking at the A12, stop, you know, A10 is like very large, so let's stop here and agree that having all these many iterations with the same tensor is a strong indication that you have reached a fixed point. Yeah. Okay? Good. So then time for conclusions. I started in the first lecture telling you about this important result called the Ariel law. The Ariel law is a property of ground states of d-dimensional local Hamiltonians. And what I like about the Ariel law, apart from being useful in practice for algorithms, is that it's telling you something universal about ground states. Okay? Ground states can be ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, superconducting, whatever, spin liquids. Okay? But all of them go by the Ariel law, or maybe logarithmic corrections to the Ariel law. So this is something very fundamental about ground states. It's a fundamental truth of nature, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So we have this Ariel law. And the example I gave you is in one dimension. The Ariel law meant that the entropy on the ground state, the entropy on a finite region, was proportional to the size of the boundary, which is a constant. Okay? So the Ariel law in one dimension meant that the amount of entanglement we have in the region is a constant. And that was captured by this toy model where we just had nearest neighbor entangled states. Now, then we moved to statistical partition functions, which is what we really wanted to talk about. And then in these special dimensions, capital D being equal to small d plus 1, we have the equivalent, the equivalent of the area law. Okay? And the toy model made that very explicit. We were in two dimensions then, and we saw that after some simplifications using these corner double line tensors, CDL tensors, after some simplifications where when we were looking at the region of the partition function, all the internal loops were numbers, so could be simplified. And what we are left with is something that just looks like the one-dimensional spin chain. Okay? And that is a way of understanding that if we now try to break this part of the partition function into two pieces according to an axis like this, we only need to cut two points, exactly as in here. So we have this version of the area law also acting on partition functions. Okay? That's the theory underlying the success of TRG. So what we did first was to understand that, well, we can exploit these properties. We can break our tensors in a sequential way. And because of this partition function version of the area law, we are guaranteed that at least when we're off criticality in two dimensions, that we can very efficiently truncate these tensors without making a big error and iterate this process and eventually compute huge partition functions very quickly with a cost that is only logarithmic in the system size. Okay? So computationally, TRG is very powerful in two dimensions. And also, it's very simple to program. So this afternoon, you'll have your own TRG code. Okay? And finally, so computationally, this is fantastic. And maybe that's your starting point for studying systems related to quantum gravity. But if you wanted to recover the structure of a correct structure of RG flows, or something that works also nicely at criticality, you had to modify that. And this is a more recent algorithm. Very good. And then the big challenge, of course, in the field is to go to larger dimensions, three dimensions, four dimensions. That's the big challenge. That's where, you know, if you get excited about what you've heard and you want to contribute, please do. We really need something here. And finally, how does this relate to spin foams? Well, you'll have to ask Benjamin and Bianca starting tomorrow. OK? All right, thank you. Lunch, questions. It's always a question.
Yeah, so in 2D, have you been able to find some new interesting physics just using these powerful methods?
It's very difficult to find new interesting physics in two dimensions.
So you're using it as more like tests and like.
Yes. So, well, OK, the claim is that it's very hard to find physics in two dimensions that have not been already discovered. And that's what I heard for many years. And only recently, people coming from ADS-CFT started to tell me that, oh, actually, no, we don't know so much in two dimensions. For instance, CFTs, conformal field theories in two dimensions, which we could use these techniques to study. Actually, apparently, you have the integral models, the minimal models, the unitary models, with central charge smaller than one. And then when you go beyond that, you have other series that you can also study analytically. But they are based on having extended symmetries. And if you remove all these symmetries, apparently, if I ask you, give me a CFT with central charge larger than one, and with no symmetry content that is enforcing this, then the answer is Liouville, which is not very well understood. And nobody else seems to come up with other examples. Okay, so there are things to do still in two dimensions. But I would say that to first approximation, the interesting problems are in three and four dimensions.
Let me add that we consider models and they were more complicated and a priori we didn't know how they behaved.
Okay.
And maybe these are spin chains and found faces.
Okay, but it's a matter of, so I agree with your definition of interesting.
Series, but it's kind of, if you have a model,
so those are gap phases though, most likely. You know? Mm-hmm. Yes. So it is true that, you can build always build a more complicated model. By interesting physics, I meant related to, you know, there is first a question driven by some material or some, right? So this is condensed matter. If you were in condensed matter, right, then there is a difference between the models that you cook up in your head because you want to and the models that might be relevant to some particular phenomena that is being studied in a lab, right? And I was referring to that type, so to the second type. So there are there open questions about, say, the ground state of a one-dimensional spin chain? You can engineer something, but the first answer is no. We have been techniques for many years, and they can address most of the cases of interest in 1+1, or the equivalent in partition functions would be 2 dimensions, right? Now, you can always make it more challenging. You could have 25 copies of the Ising model and then couple them in some way, right? And then all these methods would break because the one dimension that you would need to start with would be too large. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Question is, I mean, is there something here that allows you to actually implement this on a non-equilibrium system, in which case, for example, there are transport questions, which are still very, are not very well understood analytically. There are models for transport, even in fundamental models, whether your techniques would be useful.
Okay, so my answer about is everything known in 1+1 or 2? Dimensions was about statics, about yes. So if you start studying transport, then it's a next level of complexity. And actually, you can do certain things. And so even for spin chains, there are finite temperature algorithms that work well. The finite temperature is okay, but do you have dynamics, time evolution? So there are algorithms for time evolution, okay. But what fails there is that during a time evolution in a quantum system, in a spin chain, during the time evolution, even if you start with a state that satisfies the area law, that has a small amount of entanglement, and therefore can be written or expressed in terms of tensor network, over time, this time evolution generates more and more entanglement. Okay? And at some point, there is so much entanglement that you can no longer, you know, this spectrum of singular values over time starts doing like this, right, and cannot be truncated anymore. So this is a big challenge. Yes, if you ask me about dynamics in 1+1 dimensions, there are still interesting problems there that we don't know how to address. Yes. Okay, excellent.